Hello, and welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based tutoring in your home by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs in the IEP process.
Welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Today we are chatting with education attorney Brian Gruber. Brian Gruber is an attorney. He heads the law office of Brian K. Gruber, PC, a Washington, D.C. area law firm whose entire practice is dedicated to education law. Brian's journey into the world of special education began in a law school clinic during the 1995-96 school year, and he has been representing children with special needs and their parents ever since. Brian is well known in special education circles as a persuasive advocate who often is able to obtain a desired outcome for clients without having to resort to adversarial or costly litigation. Now in his 26th school year, working on the behalf of families, a substantial part of Brian's time is spent attending IEP meetings across Maryland and the District of Columbia. When problems can't be solved at the table and more traditional legal resolution becomes necessary, Brian has participated in hundreds of mediations, due process hearings, and federal court appeals. Brian has appeared before both the D.C. Circuit and Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, the United States District Courts of Maryland, and the District of Columbia, and in 2003 was admitted as a member of the Bar of the United States Supreme Court. Brian is a frequent speaker in professional and academic circles, including 5 consecutive years at the International Learning Disabilities Association Conference, and has been a guest lecturer at numerous college, graduate schools, law schools, and PhD programs. Brian is married to an elementary school teacher. They are parents of 3 grown children, all of whom attended public school. Brian's oldest son is a teacher, as were both of his parents. So welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today, Brian. I'm really excited to have our conversation and talk about what's going on during a pandemic and how that applies to our kiddos with special needs.
Well, thank you for having me, Wendy. I'm excited to be here. I look forward to our conversation.
So obviously the pandemic has created an unusual and even unprecedented situation for many schools nationwide. What are the biggest concerns facing families with regards to students and special education programs and accommodations? Let's just kind of dive right in here.
Sure. No reason to no reason to tiptoe into the water. Wendy, the biggest challenge right now is adjusting to the new normal and recognizing that distance learning for most school systems across the country is the norm. It's the modality of service delivery. Unfortunately, very few children truly benefit from this model. There are some students, many of them neurotypical, who can attend to a computer screen for hours at a time, who have the attention, who have the cognitive flexibility to be able to benefit from instruction. But for the population that we serve, students with special needs, it really creates some challenges. And across the spectrum of ages, as well as levels of disability, nothing really replicates that relationship that you're able to build with a teacher or service provider. Nothing replicates the rapport, the interaction that comes from that in-person instruction. And it's a real challenge. And I understand both sides of the equation. As you said in my bio, I come from a family of teachers. My wife is a teacher. She's in our home right now teaching a class. My oldest son is a teacher. You know, I understand the concerns and I share those concerns in terms of safety, in terms of what COVID brings to the table for educators. But I also understand the flip side to the equation and the impact on our students. And so, frankly, the impact and the way in which our students are being served is the biggest issue of the moment. And I don't see that going away anytime soon.
So what do we do? And I think that's part of this conversation that we're having is to educate parents and educate people, folks that are listening to, if your kid is struggling consistently and communication with the school hasn't helped, what should parents be looking for? What should parents do for like their next step? You know, we're in this situation, obviously for safety reasons, and we're trying to figure this out, but how do we protect and support this vulnerable population?
I think the key, Wendy, is to dial the conversation back a drop and recognize that for students with disabilities, their needs and the services that they should be receiving are defined by an individualized education plan, an IEP. And the I in IEP is the critical answer to your question. It's individualized. And how can the educational services for the particular student be individualized for that particular student? Now, again, we have to have that conversation in the context of what our reality looks like. So the parents who I'm finding struggle the greatest in terms of advocacy are the ones who are insistent upon particular outcomes, such as demanding that a school building opens to educate their child in person. Those families are going to continue to run into difficulty, even though they may very well be right because of who their child is. The conversation really needs to be, how can we individualize the approach to education for my child? What are the specific barriers to my child's learning? What are the available resources, and how can we marry the two?
I like how you said that, just specific to the child and coupled with available resources, because I think that's a really big thing. Who gets to decide what's reasonable, what's available, what's appropriate, just really kind of going to the core of this of free and appropriate education? How does that come about in these times, and how can parents kind of understand that process and know what to advocate for?
So I think the equation doesn't really change just because we are in a different modality of service delivery. We're always in a conversation with our students around their, you know, their individual needs in their IEP. And whether it is spoken or unspoken, school teams are often thinking in terms of what do we have within our building, what do we have access to that we can deliver to the child. Parents need to get into these conversations with very specific types of requests. It's always the obligation of the school team to consider any request the parents make. And then, of course, if there's a denial, if the school team says that they can't or unwilling to provide it, that disagreement needs to be documented. How we problem solve around a disagreement is a lengthier conversation that I'm glad to have with you now or later on in our program or in a different program. But how we problem solve around a disagreement always varies in terms of what the disagreement is, how significant that disagreement is. But nevertheless, parents need to ask for what they specifically believe the child needs and support that with some sort of documentation, be it reports, be it data, be it informal observations, something. It can't just be a blanket statement on a parent belief. That's rarely persuasive.
So how would a parent be proactive? I kind of have a couple questions here. I want to really kind of talk about what free and appropriate education is. But before we get into that piece, how does a parent plan for that request? Like, how do they know what's available? How would they be proactive kind of before they get to your door? What is something that parents could do to say, all right, you know, sometimes you don't know what you need to ask for or how to ask or even what's available. So what is their platform for that?
So I think, Wendy, it starts with identifying the problem. And many times families come to me for a consultation and obviously they're unhappy, or otherwise they wouldn't be making an appointment to come and talk to a lawyer. But it's important to drill down and identify to the best that they're capable of doing what the problem is, not what are the challenges or what's not happening, but what's the problem. So let me give you an example. Sometimes families will come to me and say, they're not providing reading, or he's not getting the level of reading intervention he's supposed to be getting. That's a concern. But if we dial it back, the problem is your child's not making the type of reading progress you would like to see or believe that the child is capable of. So we've identified the problem. Now we move into what's happening or not happening and what the challenges are. And then we can move into what do we think the solution is or the remedy for this. And again, I don't want to hear those words come out of my mouth. I don't like the tone of it, but I don't think it's productive to say, I want tutoring. That's vague. You want to be more precise in terms of you want direct and explicit reading instruction provided by somebody qualified to provide that instruction with the intensity that is recommended in order for your child to make the gains. Now, how can we achieve that? And from there, the conversation can be, is the school capable of delivering that additional reading instruction? If not, are the parents able to identify a provider in the community that can provide it? And can the parents make a demand of the school system to fund that private resource? But we have to start with identifying the problem, identifying the challenges, what's happening or not happening, or what where there's that level of dissatisfaction, and then we can get into the solution. Now, before the parents go beyond doing that internal conversation within themselves in terms of what's the problem, what are the challenges, what do we want specifically to happen as a solution, you need to take a look at what supports do you have that help objectively somebody who doesn't know your child to be able to say, I see your point. So it may start with, do you have assessments either done by the school or done by somebody privately that can point to where the deficit is or the lack of growth? Do you have authentic experience in terms of working with your child? And this distance learning period, this remote period of remote instruction that is so dependent on technology gives us some great tools. And I'll come back to that in a second. But if we have authentic work samples, oftentimes written language mirrors reading. And again, I'm using reading as an illustration, but we can talk about this in terms of math. We can talk about it in terms of behavior. Any domain is going to lead us to this. What does it look like in terms of the child's ability to do the work that's being expected to do that work independently? And from there, we can now target what the problem is going to be. I started to say, I promised I'd come back to it, and I don't want to forget to, that this distance learning period is providing us with access to technologies that are phenomenal in terms of authentication. Video lessons can be recorded. Parents can use their smartphones or apps on their computer to record their child doing work. Now, there are prohibitions in terms of recording other children in that instruction, but certainly what your child is doing can be recorded and documented. We can talk more about some of these advocacy tips later on, if you'd like, or now, if you'd like. But the use of technology and the ability to create a portfolio that supports the parents' concerns has never been better.
And I think that goes along with when they speak with you or when they speak with an advocate. I think as a mama, you're coming from this place of fear and love, or as a parent, you're coming from this place of fear and love. And you know, it's not necessarily a gotcha for the school system. It's really kind of being thoughtful and that understanding, like you had said earlier on, of just kind of let's take a step back and let's really be specific with what we're asking for and kind of building an understanding for others to see in that approach. So it really kind of circles back for me is, can you share with us about free and appropriate education, what that looks like, what the law says, so that when you are going to approach a school system, you have that understanding as a parent?
Sure. So I think the first place to start, and I'm big on context. I think some of my answers already this morning will demonstrate that. But I'm very big on understanding the context of any conversation regarding a child's legal rights. And it's important to understand that the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act provides for every child who is eligible for special education to receive this concept of what we call FAPE, free appropriate public education. Free meaning no cost to the parents, appropriate, we'll jump over for a second. Public education, roughly meaning administered by the public school agency with the same state standards and same curriculum and same expectations we would hold out for all of our kids. But the sweet spot in the conversation is always the word appropriate. Now, what I laugh at, and it's not funny for in any real sense, but I always laugh at the irony of this, is that only lawyers and only Congress could have created a law whose central tenet that governs every one of the stakeholders in the law, parents, teachers, schools, is the word appropriate, and not provided a definition of what that word means. I mean, nothing could be more vague than to just say appropriate. And what appropriate means, it has twice been before the United States Supreme Court, early on in the Rowley case and more recently in the Andrew F. case, where no lesser authority than the United States Supreme Court has had to weigh in on what does that word appropriate mean and what goes into that entitlement. In a nutshell, what an appropriate education for a child means is that, number one, it's delivered through his IEP, and I'm going to be gender neutral. I default to he, but sometimes I'll switch to she, and forgive me for that. It needs to be delivered through the IEP, and the IEP has to be reasonably calculated to provide the child with meaningful educational benefit based upon their circumstances. Again, more vagary. It's individualized. It's got to be meaningful. It can't be the legal term of de minimis, meaning very minimum. And again, I think sometimes that this law was written and court decisions have been written to less of an extent to benefit children and more of an extent to benefit lawyers and those who practice in this area, because we're constantly trying to untangle what appropriate means and what meaningful based upon a child's circumstances can mean. Here's the important takeaway from the question that you asked. What courts, including the United States Supreme Court, has said over and over and over again is that the word appropriate, unfortunately, doesn't mean best. It doesn't mean maximize a child's potential. It doesn't mean afford them every possible opportunity or resources for success. It means to move the needle in a truly meaningful way for the child. It's critical in any conversation about whether a child is receiving a meaningful education to take a step back to make sure that the IEP is identifying all of the areas in which the child's disability or disabilities impacts that child in the school setting, both in the academic as well as the non-academic aspects of their day, and addresses those needs so that we can then have a meaningful conversation about whether that child is in fact making meaningful progress relative to themselves.
What does meaningful progress look like?
That's the question, Wendy, that keeps me busier than sometimes I would like to be. Meaningful progress looks differently for every child, and that's what the court has said, and that's what the court really articulated in the Andrew F. Decision. I'll give you an example of the challenge that we get into trying to identify meaningful. If I were to suffer financial misfortune and have a dollar to my name, and all the money that I have in the world is in my pocket and it's $1, and I'm walking down the street in the morning and I come across a quarter. And I pick up that quarter and put it in my pocket. Objectively, we would say that I increased my entire net worth by 25%. And that on its face looks like I've made meaningful financial progress on that day. I mean, I increased my wealth by 25%. But I haven't increased my buying power at the dollar store. I still can only buy one item at the dollar store on a tax-free day.
Right.
So
exactly.
Is that quarter meaningful progress, even though it represents an increase of 25% of my wealth? By a data point, we would say yes. Who could argue with 25% financial increase? Have I made meaningful progress? No. So the conversation about what is meaningful progress really has to be very individualized. I'll give you another real-world educational example of a conversation that we had. I had a student on my caseload with severe language-based learning disability, average cognitive ability, but the level of dyslexia was really quite profound. Putting aside the, you know, the questions about methodologies and approach, I don't want to get into that for this portion of the conversation, but we're in an IEP meeting and the school had decided that they were going to continue to work on an increase in his sight word fluency. And the data point for this young guy was something like he had 9 sight words that he consistently recognized. And this, by the way, a second or third grader at the time of the conversation. And the school proposed an IEP that, that said he was going to, by the end of the year, he would increase his sight word fluency to 27 words. We have 27 words after. And similar to my quarter on the street conversation, the school's argument was we're trying to increase his knowledge of sight words, you know, threefold. We're going from 9 to 27. That seems great to us. And I had to stop them and say, fine. But a year from now, when he has those 27 words, the gap between this child and his age and grade peers is going to be so much greater, because gaining those additional 18 sight words is not going to be meaningful for him. He's not going to have any more meaningful access to grade level text. He's not going to be able to access curriculum any greater, even though, you know, by an objective standard, we've increased his bank of sight words threefold. We're not moving him any further along in the curriculum in a truly meaningful way. I finished the conversation with the school team by saying, a year from now, when we come back and talk about this student and his needs and his learning, and you tell me that he's at 27 words and he's met that goal, are we going to be celebrating? Are we going to really feel like we're on the right track with this child? And when the school team digested that conversation in that context, we had agreement that their approach with the student was not working, that he was not making meaningful progress relative to himself, because he did have average cognitive ability. And so the rate of progress and the expectation, given the right interventions and the right methodology, should have been significantly greater. We should have been holding a much higher bar for him, and he definitely needed a different approach. So you have to approach every conversation about what is meaningful with really the context of who this child is, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, what our expectations are and should be, so that we can figure out where we're going.
So in terms of students that are trying to gain skills to be with their same age peers, and the school system that's trying to formulate goals that are meaningful for that student, that align with an individualized education plan, but still need to move that child forward at a rate that is pretty intense in a lot of the school systems. How would you approach an IEP team to say, what is meaningful, what is individualized, what is still going to help keep that student in line with the growth that's expected from a school system?
So we don't get into that level of conversation until we have fully developed the IEP. So where you're really focused on your question is in terms of the supplementary aids, and the direct services, the service delivery model, and ultimately the placement if we're back in a classroom setting, the least restrictive environment. For me, it always starts at the beginning of the IEP, the present level section of the IEP, what are now called the present levels of academic and functional performance, the first part of the IEP, because a well-written present level will incorporate multiple data sources, objective testing, as well as subjective testing and classroom-based assessments and teacher feedback, as well as hopefully feedback from parents and whatever work samples that the parents are able to collect and provide in coordination with the school team. So it always starts with, similar to the dichotomy that I gave you about understanding the problem and then figuring out what to be asking the school for. It always starts with, who is this child? What are the barriers to this child's learning? What are reasonable expectations and what are not reasonable expectations? And from there, we can move through in terms of looking at goals and figuring out what is going to be meaningful and what we should be expecting. So similar to the example that I gave you before, which was a real life example from an IEP discussion in the state of Maryland, is a child with average cognitive ability working towards a high school diploma. We should be tracking that child's progress in relation to grade level expectations, and we should be trying to close the gap or at least do nothing to enable that gap to widen between where they are and who are their peers. For a child not working towards a diploma, we really want to target that conversation towards what is truly meaningful for that child. Another example that I can give you is that I had a student that I was involved with for a number of years who was not going to be working towards a diploma due to this child's very significant cognitive disabilities, but it was very critical that this child's academics be made functional. And for a number of years prior to me being involved in the case, the IEP team had been targeting number recognition and one-to-one correspondence. And this goal had been on the student's IEP for a number of years. And when I sat down with the IEP team, I said to them, how many years are we going to continue to work on this? And if the student were to achieve it, what comes next? What does the student do with this information? I don't want to take away anything from a student. I don't want to hold a lower bar, but something's got to be different. You know, one of the expressions I picked up from listening to a podcast a few summers ago that school teams are a little bit tired of hearing me say now is, but if nothing changes, nothing changes. And I really think that that's a very profound statement. If we continue to be working on one-to-one correspondence and the student's not getting it, we have to ask, is there a different way to teach this, or is this really meaningful for the student? And so, again, it's the long answer to your short question, but every conversation about what's meaningful, about what expectations should be, starts with who is this child, what are their patterns, strengths, and weaknesses, and how are they showing up in the real world in relation to age and grade level expectations. And then we go from there.
I think it's an excellent way to say that. This is really having that pause for the team in its entirety to develop that IEP is ensuring that thoughtful approach to who is this child specifically and how can we help them become the best version of themselves. And so kind of brings us back to that appropriate education, right? And so you've mentioned a couple times the Andrew F. decision. Can you share a little bit about that for folks that may not be familiar with that decision and how that was an impact for students that qualify for special education?
Sure. So the Andrew F. case is the most recent, significant Supreme Court decision involving special education students. And the quick background on Andrew F. is that the Supreme Court in, I think it's 1985, in what's called the Rowley case, had issued the most significant legal guidance that we have in terms of what does it mean for the word appropriate? What are a student's entitlements under IDEA? And the court had said that the child is entitled to an IEP that's reasonably calculated to enable the child to make educational progress. Well, the court had left open the question of how much progress satisfies the school system's obligation. And there was a split amongst the different states in the country and the federal judicial circuits that govern the states in terms of what amount of progress would satisfy a public school's obligation to the student to say that the student has received FAPE. In parts of the country, the word meaningful prevailed. And this meaningful standard, the courts had specifically said a child's education has to truly be meaningful. Other states had said, no, any amount of progress, my quarter on the street with my dollar in the pocket analogy, would suffice. Any amount of progress is progress. If you knew 20 letters of the alphabet when you came, when you started the school year, and you knew all 26 at the end of the school year, that was progress. And so that was the prevailing opinion of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, which governs portions of the western part of our country, where Andrew, a student with autism, lived in Colorado. And his parents were dissatisfied with the progress that Andrew was making under IEPs in their local school system, claiming that he wasn't making progress that would constitute FAPE. They took that case to a due process hearing, which is always the first step in legally challenging what the school system was doing, and they lost. And I should interject that the parents had removed Andrew from public school and put him in a private school where he was making terrific gains, showing that he could learn given the right supports and accommodations and environment. And the parents were asking the school system to fund this private placement. Well, they lost at the due process level, and they exercised their right to appeal to federal court, and they lost there too, and they didn't like that decision. They took it to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and the 10th Circuit said, again, de minimis progress is progress, and I'm paraphrasing now, and probably not too nicely. But in any case, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with everybody underneath, and the parents pursued further and went to the United States Supreme Court. And in a really surprisingly unanimous decision that I, for one, did not see coming. Amongst our circles, I was not entirely optimistic of this outcome. But in a unanimous decision, the United States Supreme Court issued a ruling that said a small amount of progress, you know, progress in the name of progress is not what IDEA is all about. Children with disabilities have the right to an IEP that is reasonably calculated to provide them with opportunity to make meaningful progress relative to themselves. And that last part, the relative to themselves part, is the newest language that we add into the conversation of appropriate based upon Chief Justice Roberts' decision in the indirect case. It really ties back to who this child is, how they show up in the world, and what reasonable expectations for progress can be based upon the child's unique circumstances, their strengths, their weaknesses, the extent of their disability, what the expectations are. It, in theory, set up a higher bar for school systems to try to approve. And Chief Justice Roberts went on and said, every child is entitled to challenging objectives. We should not be holding a low bar for students. We should be setting a high bar and challenging those students based upon what collectively we think they are capable of achieving. We should be aiming high. And I will say, as somebody who has spent almost my entire life living under the same roof with educators, you know, reiterating that both of my parents were educators. My wife is a career teacher, and I have a son who's a teacher. I know that teachers get up in the morning and want to see their students succeed, but there is no teacher who goes to bed at night satisfied that their student has made some progress. Teachers want to see their students reach their potential. The Supreme Court didn't find that that was the obligation of schools. It didn't impose that obligation, but it did instruct the public schools that FAPE requires schools to try to stretch kids, to try to set high bars and to provide them with the resources to enable them to make truly meaningful progress, again, based upon their circumstances.
What a good answer to that and an explanation to that in terms of that stretching component. And we, you know, as a special educator myself, we all want our kiddos to find that sweet spot between stretching but not frustrating, and to help them grow and learn. So in this time of COVID and distance learning or hybrid learning, depending on the school that your child is in right now, what creative ways have you seen during virtual learning? Have you seen teams support kiddos? Have you seen this as something where you're like, oh, this is an excellent way. We've kind of now opened some doors to show that we can do this, and this is something that could possibly continue? Or is there just ways that you're like, this is an excellent way to figure out how to really, you know, a student with a one-on-one aid, how do we really engage them with that support virtually?
So I've seen a variety of different approaches. You know, some have been successful, others, unfortunately, have not been successful. And it continues to go back to looking at individual kids and what they can and what they can't take away from this unfortunate distance learning time. One of the things that I've seen schools be able to do differently on virtual platforms than they could in a classroom setting is direct one-to-one or very small group instruction. Oftentimes in a larger classroom, it is difficult, almost impossible to deliver or to control, because there are all kinds of variables from the behaviors of other students in the cohort to limitations on time. But I have seen in this virtual platform where schools have been able to say, the special educator will create 20 minutes out of her day to work with your daughter one-to-one. I've seen teachers be able to schedule individual conferences, almost like a college level office hours, or even elementary school students, for those students to log on and have a one-to-one conversation similar to what we're having right now. I have seen increase in the ability of parents to interact with teachers in this digital world and be able to share authentic examples of what the student is able to do independently versus with some direct involvement of a teacher. The line between what happens in the schoolhouse and happens at home has completely vanished. It isn't even blurred anymore. It's completely gone. And so the ability of schools and parents to have these flexible conversations and then for the school to adapt in ways similar to what I just described is the most promising. What continues to not be wholly realistic in most situations are for students who need a one-to-one and need somebody who is physically right there next to them to be able to deliver that. And my office right now is working on behalf of several students with a few different school systems in the area, on behalf of some students who have severe disabilities, who require that direct, sometimes hand-over-hand or instruction, or that one-to-one instruction, somebody right next to them for attention or for language or for behavior, where a provider that the parents have hired has been able to come into the house, and we are asking the school systems to fund this in recognition that schools can't put their own personnel into private homes because of safety concerns. But the parents who have the means to do that certainly can. It becomes a whole other conversation about equity in education, because we are really at the mercy of parents who have means and parents who don't. But in terms of what schools are able to do, a lot of times it's tailoring and providing more direct individual instruction has been the best, and the inability to make it in person has been the biggest challenge.
You know, and you're right, the equity component, that's a whole nother conversation and a podcast within itself. Absolutely. And it's going to be interesting to see how when the dust settles, when we can, you know, everybody's safe to return to school, what that looks like. You know, we kind of talked a little bit about advocacy in the beginning of this conversation. What would you offer as some suggestions to try prior to connecting with a lawyer and going that legal intervention route?
So I think, Wendy, the big misnomer in your question is that parents are only smart to connect with a lawyer when they have not been successful. Parents should be thinking about connecting with a lawyer within special education when they have gotten to the point where they are of the impression that things are not working to the way that they want them to work, or are at the point where they feel like they are not being successful in communicating their concerns with the IEP team. Special education is a very highly jargon-laden aspect of law and very jargon-dependent, even within education. And experienced special education attorneys, educational consultants, lay advocates play an important role in helping to educate parents and shape the conversations they have with the school team. But if a parent really wanted to pursue this first before going to a lawyer once they find that they are in a problem, I think the best suggestion I have is what we talked about earlier within this conversation today, to really try to drill down not just on why I'm dissatisfied, but what is the specific problem that you're seeing? What is happening or not happening with your student that makes you want to talk about doing things different? The biggest pitfall that I see, and you didn't ask me this, but I'll take the liberty in offering it. The biggest pitfall that I see is where parents come to the table with a solution without having vetted the entire problem-solving part of the conversation. And the reason that I say that that's a problem is twofold. One is that it locks the parents into a position without having heard the other side, and you know, meaning the school team's perspective and their interpretation of the conversation. The second is that if a parent comes in with a very specific request and the school agrees and the child doesn't make progress, the parent is in part to blame. Now, that's not to say that the parent is wrong and that even the most informed parents and the most educated parents, sometimes things don't work and sometimes the outcomes are not what we had hoped them to be. But if a school is using a certain approach and the parent comes in and without the benefit of really having gone through that problem identification exercise that I've spoken now a couple of times about, and comes in and says to the school team, I want and I'm demanding that you do things differently. And the school team throws up its hands and says, you know, we're not going to argue with you, Mrs. Taylor. We're going to do things exactly the way you asked them to do. If the outcome is not what we all want, now the parent has, unfortunately, a little bit less credibility in the next round of conversation. So I'm not a giant fan of parents coming into school-based conversations with specific demands before really having had that conversation about, here's the problem, here's what we see or is happening or not happening. These are our ideas in terms of what we think will problem solve. And we want to have a conversation about our perspective as well as the school team's perspective, because again, nothing changes. We're all interested in seeing the child succeed.
And I love that collaborative approach.
Thank you.
And that really makes the team a team, right? So that everybody's putting this information out there, hearing it, being thoughtful, thinking of the student, looking at the present levels, then defining our goals and supplementary aids and services so that we can truly support this student in a way that they need to be supported, but in this collaborative team way. What tip could you give, because you have sat at that table, an IEP table, many, many times, what tip could you give? Because we've talked a lot about parents and trying to give advice for parents and educate and inform them, but what tip could you give to a special ed teacher and or an IEP team? Out of all the years you've done this, I can't even count how many IEPs you've probably sat through. What is a tip that you think this is a fantastic standout special education teacher, or this is a fantastic standout IEP team?
So I've got a couple. First of all, it's always going to come down to communication. It is always going to come down to lowering your guard, lowering your defenses, and doing your best to hear each other out. And where school teams have been most effective all the years that I've been doing this, where they have been most effective is in recognizing that the words that come out of the mouths of parents are not always the words that the parents want to be using. They are more reflective of the limitations of the parents' vocabulary in relation to the emotion and in relation to their child. IEP meetings are in theory designed for parents to be equal participants. Well, in reality, that's never the case. Parents, for the most part, know their children. Parents have a perspective in terms of how their child is doing. But school teams and educators have a level of expertise that has been honed from formalized education and experience with children other than the one that you are parenting. And so it's a problem anytime either side disregards what one brings to the table. And so similar to what I spoke about with parents, you know, needing to be hearing and considering the school team's perspective, it's equally important for school staff to be hearing the parents. And when I talk about school staff hearing the parents, I don't mean that you heard the actual word that came out of the parent's mouth, but what's the context? What do they mean? What are they trying to communicate? The parent may be very articulate They may be highly educated, highly successful. Doesn't mean they're precise in their language and saying things in the way that they want the IEP team to hear. So that would be the first tip. The second, which goes along with the first, and is much easier for me to say than it is for special educators, gen educators, and school teams to actually implement, is to not take things personally. It's really hard when a teacher has been working with a student and a parent comes into a meeting and says, I'm not happy with what you're doing with my child. What the parent is really saying is, I was hoping for or expecting a different outcome. It's really hard for teachers not to take that conversation as a personal insult to them. It's almost got to be mechanical in your way of hearing it. You know, I drive my car. I know my car. But when I bring it to the mechanic and I tell the mechanic what the problem is, the mechanic doesn't presume that the words that came out of my mouth are the diagnosis. The mechanic's got to actually look under the hood, got to put the car up on the rack and take a look. And the mechanic should not be taking Brian's opinion on what's wrong with the car. The mechanic should be listening to Brian's concern. And if the car at the end of the day, it continues to have the same challenges, the mechanic can't take it personally. The mechanic's got to go back and think, you know, is there something else I could be doing? Is there something else we as an auto shop can be doing, or could we be doing differently? Or is there different expertise that I need to tap into? Or maybe this is not the right shop for this particular car or this particular car owner. And IEP teams and school teams have to be approaching conversations with parents along those same ways. Hearing the parents, not taking parental concerns personally, recognizing that we are all in this conversation together about the individual child. We may not be on the same page at the end of the day, but we have to start there. Now, you asked in your question before my long answer about some examples, and one that has stuck with me, it's been a number of years now, but it stuck with me as the greatest thing an IEP team has ever done, and this is my 26th school year attending IEP meetings, was on behalf of a student in Frederick County, Maryland. I give a shout out because it really was what I'm about to tell you I thought was truly brilliant. And the parents really believed that the student had a higher skill set than the school-based team. And that's where there was a lot of tension. And with parental consent, the teacher recorded lessons that she had been working on with the student. And when we sat down as an IEP team, the school had the computer projected on a screen. And so when we talked about the present levels section, and we talked about reading, this teacher had a clip of what the instruction looked like, what the student's attention was, what the skill level was, that supported the narrative that was in the IEP. And I thought that was brilliant. I was speechless at it because that teacher had heard the parents' concern. They had heard the words that were coming out of the mouths of the parents. She had taken them to heart. She wasn't defensive about the approach that she was bringing to the table, but she had authentic documentation, not to refute the parents, but to say, this is what it looks like. We recognize that you feel differently, but this is what it looks like for us.
That's excellent.
And that was a brilliant approach. I had another teacher in Montgomery County who was recommending a different program for the student. And I think because I came into the conversation a little late, I wasn't late to the meeting, but I was late in terms of the development of this conversation. This teacher sat down at the IEP table with authentic samples of grade level work. This is what my grade level students are supposed to be working on. This is an authentic example of what I am working on with your child. And this is an authentic example of what your child is able to do independently. And this teacher had those three sets of authentic examples. These are the materials we use in class. These are the materials I'm using with your kid. This is what happens when we take independent work, as we do in our general education class, for your child to work. And so where that child fit in terms of this child's ability to make progress along the general education curriculum could not have been any clearer. And again, when we went through the IEP, those authentic, objective examples demonstrated that this teacher had heard the parents' concern, had put thought into how can I respond to those concerns without taking it personally, and how can I show you the reason, the justification for what we're doing with your child and why we want to try to do something better.
Excellent advice. It wraps it all up from just taking that individualized, meaningful, authentic approach. What is one case you've worked on that's inspired you?
There are really a couple that come to mind. Both of them are early cases in my career and that continue to propel me as the hair on my head has vanished and the hair on my face has turned from dark brown to solid white. The very first case that I litigated as a supervised law student involved a nonverbal girl with severe intellectual disability who also likely had autism, who was in a public school in the District of Columbia. And this little girl had a very tragic birth story. She had been born to a parent who also had an intellectual disability. The birth mother didn't know she was pregnant until the baby arrived, and the child was being raised by a very lovely but somewhat limited grandmother, and the child had a broken arm, and the grandmother insisted that it happened in the school, and the school was insisting it couldn't have happened there. But of course, the child was nonverbal and didn't have any effective method of communication. And we litigated that student successfully into a private special education school for students with severe intellectual disabilities. And within 2 years in that program, the student had an effective system of communication and was able to independently communicate her wants and needs and was able to work towards having an independent life. And that was a case at the end of the due process hearing that my supervising attorney, the late Mary Hines, said to me, you really should do this, consider doing this after law school. You really got it and you're really good at it. And winning that case made a huge difference in this little girl's life and in her ability to have some degree of independence. And that was one that I continue this day to really be proud of. But there was another one that perhaps was almost more profound. And it was after I'd been practicing for a number of years, a family came in to see me for a consultation, and they were very clearly immigrants. They spoke very heavily accented English. Their ability to communicate was somewhat compromised. And they told me their story that they had a young boy, I think it was about 6 years old, maybe a little bit older, who very clearly had been diagnosed at the Children's Hospital with autism. And the school psychologist had also said that this child had an intellectual disability. And the parents were okay with the autism diagnosis, but they weren't okay with the intellectual disability. And in part because, and this is way longer than before Andrew F., but they were concerned that saying that the student had an intellectual disability was going to change the trajectory of educational outcomes. In fact, the intellectual disability identified by this particular school psychologist was so significant that the student would be in a functional life skills class and not be working towards a high school diploma, even at a very young age. And in further conversation with the parents, they started telling me about this, their son and why they were concerned. And again, their English was extraordinarily challenging to understand. But they did a great job of telling me that this little kid, it was 6 or 8 years old or so, I don't recall, was able to ride a two-wheel bicycle without training wheels, ride all around his neighborhood and come home. They said that he was able to make his own microwave popcorn. He was able to program his VCR, which for those kind of dates us a little bit, but that was part of the skills that they had. Because he was a flight risk, they had, and because they had another child also with autism who was a flight risk, they had to install some locks very high up on their doors. And this child that they were talking about had figured out what devices in the house to stack in order to be able to reach the lock. And, you know, I had been doing this now for enough years that I understood that his problem-solving skills really sounded, quite developed, and that there was probably more cognitive ability than was demonstrated on the psychological evaluation. Now, along that same time frame, I had been doing a couple of cases with some of the professionals at what used to be called the Center for Autism and Pervasive Developmental Disorder at Children's Hospital. And so I relied on a couple of those contacts that I had developed, and I called over there and spoke to a terrific psychologist who was the director of that program at the time. And I described what this family had said. And the psychologist said, you know what, get that family in to see me. I'm going to see that kid myself right away and let you know, because I think that they're right. And that Brian, your gut is on this case is right. Now, I called the family to tell them the conversation I had, because again, this predates the use of email. So I actually called the family to tell them the conversation I just had at the Children's Hospital. And the grandmother who was living with the family answered the phone. And it was very clear that this grandmother spoke no English whatsoever. So when I eventually got a hold of the parents, I said to them, listen, tell me what language you speak in the home. And they said, oh, we only speak English. And I said, please, I recognize that you're doing the best that you can, but it's not possible that you speak only English in your home when you're living in a multi-generational household and the caretaker of this child doesn't speak any English and you're doing your best to communicate English. But please just confirm for me, you speak in your native language. And they reluctantly agreed. And so I shared that information with the psychologist at Children's, and the psychologist tested the student in his native language, which is required under IDEA. And it turned out that this child did not have an intellectual disability. This child was Chinese. And when we came back to the school with those results, the school recognized the mistake of the school system psychologist, put the kid in an autism program, and that child graduated from high school. And it's a long story that I just told you. There are many more details involved. But when you ask about cases that have inspired me, that's the one that I talk about more often than any other, because that's one where that family, having been resourceful to come to see me, and it could have been any other education attorney who kind of knew what they were doing, might have had the same outcome. But that was one where I was able to hear more than just the words that the parents were using. I was able to take them at their credibility, tap into relationships that I had developed, and truly change that child's trajectory in life. And besides being a win for that family, it was a win for that child, and one that probably close to 20 years ago, but extraordinarily proud to have contributed to that family.
Oh my goodness, that's a fantastic story. And really just kind of telling in a way to kind of wrap up our conversation today in terms of hearing parents, hearing the team, seeing, what is the true need of the child. Kind of just two little final questions. What should I ask that I didn't know enough to ask?
We touched on it, but we didn't really go into it terribly deep, which is when should a family really consider hiring or at least consulting with a special education attorney? That's a question that I get asked frequently, and I do think should be part of the conversation. And I'm going to go back to my analogy about the auto mechanic and then throw in another one with you in a moment. The biggest mistake that parents make in terms of thinking about when to hire an attorney is the perception that attorneys are only valuable in your life when you have a problem that you now need to change. And that is actually the toughest time for an attorney to get involved in a special education case, because the law requires IEP teams to make a decision, to document that decision in a poorly labeled form called a prior written notice. And then after the line in the sand has been drawn, after the school team has made its decision, then parents have a set of rights in terms of trying to overturn that. And that's always much tougher than doing the advocacy piece to try to get the school team to make the decision that you want them to make. So the best time to bring in an attorney is early enough in the process, as soon as you've identified that something is that you'd like something to happen differently than you expect. Another time to be bringing the so that's certainly preventative maintenance. It often saves you lots of money down the road to bring my car in for regular oil changes and for regular tire rotation and maintenance will theoretically save me lots of money down the road. Where if I only have a relationship with the mechanic once something is truly broken, I might be too late in terms of things that could have been fixed earlier on. The second time is once a parent identifies that they don't know what their rights are in a situation, or they don't understand what the particular conversation or jargon is about, is an excellent time for parents to really contact a special education attorney and try to sit down with us and tell your story, tell your version of who your child is and what your concerns are, and then figure out what your legal rights are. There are many times where parents get completely worked up about some aspect of their child's education, and they're wrong. Sometimes the parents come in and their perception or their conversation is, I use the word wrong, but more empathetically, I can say is not accurate or that what they think should be happening or that the, again, it's because of a language issue. And I don't mean that, English versus Chinese or another dialect, but rather because special education is so filled with jargon. There are other times, and education is different than almost any other field in what I'm about to say. There are times where understanding who the individual people are in your child's case can make a difference in terms of tapping into a resource. Education is a highly human-dependent field. And just as all human beings have strengths and weaknesses and personalities, some teachers and educators and IEP teams are more flexible, more open-minded, more resourceful than others. An experienced attorney, and this can go for consultants and advocates as well, when we know the players and we know the IEP team, oftentimes we can craft problem solving or ideas or resources that can resolve a problem quickly and very inexpensively before things escalate. I really advise families, don't wait until it's broken. Come see us as soon as you have a concern. And the other piece along with that is that the philosophy in my office and in our practice is that we won't turn away a meritorious case where we can make a difference simply because a family can't pay the fee. We can always have that conversation if money is an obstacle. I'd rather know what's going on with the child and what the situation is and have the opportunity to try to see if we can figure out a solution than have a parent and the child suffer through it simply because finances are in the way. No family should put off consulting with a professional simply because the dollars aren't in the bank.
Perfect way to end it. If you could have one final thought here, if you could have a billboard with one tip for parents, what would it be and why as we close out here?
Sure. One tip for parents right now, breathe.
So true.
It's all going to eventually work out. A longer answer than the question that you gave is that one area that I find parents really struggling with is the conversation about my child's grades and my child's inability to keep up with grade level curriculum. When this pandemic is over and schools across the country get back to in-person learning and we've sifted through this and life returns to whatever version of normal life is going to be going forward, grade and age level norms and expectations are going to be recalibrated. It's going to have to be. And your child is experiencing the same educational nightmare that all the other children in their grade are experiencing. And so there will be opportunities to make up. Now, that's a blanket statement and doesn't hold for every child. And at the very beginning, we talked about the individual nature of special education and need to individualize. But the advice I would give, and easier said than done, and I don't always take my own advice on this one, is breathe. We're going to get there. And education will get there. Special education will get there. But this is bigger than all of us, and we just have to breathe.
Breathe and just continue to communicate, continue to collaborate. Absolutely.
Continue to communicate, continue to collaborate, and recognize when your communication is not being successful, and either take a step back and figuring out where you are not connecting, why you're not connecting, or whether somebody else's voice might better enable you to
communicate. I love it. I mean, you have been so amazing and offering your time and conversation this morning and talking with us and providing some excellent nuggets of information to help support our kiddos with a variety of learning needs and differences. So I can't thank you enough for your time and coming on and talking with us today.
You're very welcome. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about special education and talk about our students and hopefully bring some calm to the discussion, turn the heat down a little bit and give some folks the opportunity to think about some things so we can move kids forward. It's all about that.
Such a pleasure. Absolutely. That's right. Moving them forward. Absolutely. Well, thank you so, so much.
Thank you for joining us today for our IEP Essentials Pro Tips podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP Essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.